Before we get started with today's episode of Patron Deities, a notice about content. In this episode, we're going to be talking about Soma, the sacred drink described in Vedic texts. What that means is that we're unavoidably going to be talking about alcohol and drugs. So if that's something that you don't think would be appropriate for some listeners or something that you don't want to hear about, you're going to want to give this whole episode a miss because basically that's what it's all about. And in that case, I hope you enjoy the next one. Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigod supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, heroes, monsters, and other mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we are taking a look at the Indian mythos section, and specifically we're talking about something that I think was kind of left out of this section. Specifically, we'll be discussing Soma, the ritual drink of the Vedic period. Okay, so what is Soma? As past episodes have mentioned, it's a sort of magical drink or nectar that the gods drink, but it's also a real drink, like it's something physical, something made from a plant that mortals can drink or offer as part of their worship. And it's also the name of a god who is embodied in it. So Soma is sometimes an individual, a person, or a divine being to whom prayers are offered, and the drink part doesn't really come into it, but most of the time it's the liquid that's being praised in the hymns that are devoted to Soma in the Rig Veda. There are a lot of them. Soma is very important in the Vedic corpus. One entire mandala of the Rig Veda is almost completely devoted to it or him. Overall, there are over 100 hymns in the Rig Veda devoted to Soma. I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head, but I think that makes it like the third biggest set of hymns after Indra and Agni. I could be wrong about that because I didn't have it written down, but it's definitely, you know, whether or not that's exactly right, it's definitely a high number. It's a lot more than some of the other deities that are in this book and that we've had reason to talk about this season, right? It's more than Vishnu. It's more than Kartikeya. And the texts of Rig Veda, especially the ninth mandala, which I mentioned previously, are full of praise for Soma and the good that it does for individuals and for the world. So here's some quotes. This is Hymn 2 of Book 9. It's the same translation that I quoted before by Ralph T.H. Griffith. It is from 1896, so. Soma, flow on, inviting gods, speed to the purifying cloth, pass into Indra as a bull, as mighty food, speed hitherward, Indu, as a most splendid steer, sit in thy place as one with strength. The well-loved mead was made to flow, the stream of the creative juice, not sure what this bit says, the sage drew waters to himself, the mighty waters, yea, the floods accompany thee, mighty one, when thou wilt clothe thee with the milk. The lake is brightened in the flood, Soma, our friend, heaven's prop and stay, falls on the purifying cloth. The tawny bull hath bellowed, fair as mighty Mitra to behold, he shines together with the sun. Songs, Indu, active in their might, are beautified for thee, wherewith thou deckest thee for our delight. To thee who givest ample room, we pray, to win the joyous draught, great are the praises due to thee. Indu, as Indra's friend, on us pour with a stream of sweetness, like Parjanya, sender of the rain. Winner of kind, Indu, art thou, winner of heroes, steeds, and strength, primeval soul and sacrifice. Or, how about this one? This is hymn number 3. Here present this immortal god flies, like a bird upon her wings, to settle in the vats of wood. This god, made ready with the hymn, runs swiftly through the winding ways, inviolable as he flows. This god, while flowing, is adorned, like a bay steed for war, by men devout and skilled in holy songs. He, like a warrior going forth with heroes as he flows along, is fain to win all precious boons. This god, as he is flowing on, speeds like a car and gives his gifts, he lets his voice be heard of all. Praised by the sacred bards, this god dives into waters and bestows rich gifts upon the worshipper. Away he rushes with his stream, across the regions into heaven, and roars as he is flowing on. While flowing, meet for sacrifice, he hath gone up to heaven across the regions, irresistible. After the way of ancient time, this god, pressed out for deities, flows tawny to the straining cloth. This lord of many holy laws, even at his birth engendering strength, effused, flows onward in a stream. So I think that hymn number three is really interesting because it's clearly describing some aspects of the distilling or like the creation of soma. Not technically distilled, I don't think. And in fact, so is hymn two, where it talks about being like clothed in milk. So whatever the soma, the actual juice, the plant product is, it's being mixed with milk and water to create the ritual drink. And it just goes on like this, right? Soma, it's good for what ails you. It gives you strength, and it also has spiritual benefits, and it's to be offered to the gods. So it's something that's to be sacrificed as much as it is to be consumed by living beings. So given how important soma is in the Vedic ritual world, that raises the question, why was soma not included in the Indian mythos section of deities and demigods? And I think that there are two reasons. The first is that this is 1980, so probably 1979 when this text is being written. The real like D&D controversies have not hit yet, but you know, Jim Ward's an educator. I'm sure that he's thinking a little bit about, well, I don't know, there's nudity and stuff in this book, but I don't know if a magic drug would necessarily be part of this section. I could be wrong about that. I think it's more the case that soma, the deity, is hard to implement in the cosmology and like the cosmology of D&D and the structure of this book, which to some extent are the same thing. That is to say that when we get to a god that isn't, you know, a person that's walking around and has hit points and things, then I think it starts to break down a little bit. And that's definitely the case with soma, who's sort of embodied in soma, the drink. That would be difficult to implement. Although, in fairness, not having a description that translates well into D&D never stopped them previously from just making one up, you know, to fit the space in the pantheon. I also think that although this section does say that it is mainly Vedic, it tends to focus on Vedic deities who maintained some kind of presence in Hinduism. So Vishnu's not necessarily very important in the Vedic texts. I'm not saying he's not important, but he's, you know, he's no Indra, he's no Agni. But he definitely gets his space here because you couldn't leave him out. He's so important in Hinduism that you couldn't not have Vishnu, even though if you asked someone, you know, who was a practitioner of the Vedic faith, pre-Hinduism, who's more important, soma or Vishnu, they definitely have said soma. So soma is a divine drink, drunk like during ritual practices, created apparently ritually, you know, where the kind of the way that it is produced is ritualized. But what exactly is it? Well, this has been the subject of great debate pretty much since people, especially since people outside India, started to read the Rig Veda. If you search on Google for soma, if you search for, you know, soma Rig Veda or something like that on Google, you will find, or at least this is what I found, primarily articles in which some scientist claims to have discovered what exactly soma is. Many different candidates have been put forward. Obviously, none of them can ever really be conclusive absent some form of archaeological evidence. A lot of a certain type of Western scholar think it is some kind of entheogen. And that makes sense because that's what they're into. I'm not saying it makes sense because that's what the texts reflect, because it doesn't. Because they do not. If you look at the effects of soma, they're described as, you know, soma is described as health-giving, you know, giving strength, promoting activity, not as necessarily like inducing some altered state of consciousness that allows communion with the divine. It was really, look, I don't think that the idea that soma is an entheogen is the scholarly consensus, but there's a lot of writing about it out there, because of course there is. As an aside, I really think that a lot of the entheogen thing is people in the mid-20th century looking for some kind of scientific origin for spiritual or religious phenomena. So trying to explain the faith and belief of human societies in scientific terms. And when they began to experiment with drugs or chemicals that could induce altered states of consciousness, they kind of projected that back into history. I'm not saying that there aren't societies in which ritual practitioners, shamans, whatever, have used drugs to induce altered states of consciousness. But the fact that drugs can induce altered states of consciousness does not mean that all altered states of consciousness are induced by drugs. We know that there are people who practice things like ecstatic dancing or fasting or meditation or sensory deprivation or whatever in order to induce altered states of consciousness without the use of any kind of drug. And I even wrote, like recently I was reading a book that suggested that Viking berserkers, you know, took some kind of hallucinogenic substance in order to drive themselves into a fighting frenzy, which I can't even, first, there's no evidence for it. Second, just imagine trying to get into a spear fight while you're on acid or something. I feel like that would not make you a better fighter. And third, there's no particular evidence that Viking berserkers, I mean, if they existed, other than as a literary trope, they are engaging in some kind of socially recognized signification of martial prowess through animal symbolism, not entering a furious battle trance. There are examples of people going fighting mad in Old Norse sagas, but none of them are berserkers. Although they do occasionally turn into bears. Pretty sure Bothred Bjarki turns into a bear in King Rolf Krake's saga. But anyway, that's not important. My point is, not all altered states of consciousness are produced by drugs. And a part of the problem, of course, is that Vedic Soma tradition doesn't really survive into modern practice. But there is a related ritual practice that does continue to exist today, and that is the role of Hauma, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, in Zoroastrianism. So the words Hauma and Soma come from the same root, and they are both sacred drinks that are said to promote health and spiritual well-being and so on, and are used in important rituals. So there's been some speculation that these go to some kind of shared Indo-Iranian rite that is the ancestor of both. Now, that doesn't mean that they would both necessarily use the same plant, so this isn't not conclusive in any way. And anyway, it's not certain that, you know, it couldn't have changed over time or anything like that, but it's possible. And what we seem to think, again, based on my, you know, relatively casual reading, is that Hauma is some kind of substance made from plants of the genus Ephedra. And so plants of this family contain compounds that you've probably heard of, right? So obviously, ephedrine or pseudoephedrine, those are two compounds that can act as stimulants. They can increase the metabolism. And even today, you know, athletes use these to like enhance their performance, even though I don't know that the scientific evidence that that works. Indeed, there is some concern that, you know, these essentially mild stimulants have got harmful side effects. So I'm not saying that Hauma is Soma or that plants used as Hauma in, you know, modern or in recent history in Zoroastrianism are necessarily some kind of ancestral Hauma, but the evidence seems to be that it is a stimulant, not a hallucinogen. It's curious, isn't it? People are very willing to attribute a lot to historical use of hallucinogens and not very willing to look at historical use of stimulants, even though we actually know, well, we're not unwilling, but like we know for a fact that the use of various kinds of stimulant is common among a lot of historical societies. And of course, we're talking about a plant that's used in ritual contexts and in traditional medicine, which means that it doesn't need to have any actual medicinal properties at all, right? It doesn't even have to be a real stimulant. Lots of plants used in herbal medicine don't do anything. But this tells you something, I think, about the values of the culture, if that makes sense. If I wanted to stereotype, I would say that the social elite of the Vedic era, the warrior caste, right? So these sort of noble warriors who often see themselves reflected in the way that gods are portrayed are definitely the kind of people who would take a load of stimulants because they prized things like physical activity, physical health, and strength. Anyway, whatever the actual identity of Soma might be, the point is that it's a special drink. It's consumed in ritual conditions. If it's produced in a ritual way, then that may mean that the supply is limited. And there definitely seem to be a lot of hymns that are about kind of rejoicing that you have Soma, which may suggest that there are times when you don't have Soma. So it may be only used by special people. It may be only used on special occasions. Speaking of intoxicants, I was thinking a little bit about our discussion of pulque in the Central American section, where we talked about the use of pulque in pre-conquest Mexico. Now, pulque, just in case you've forgotten, is an alcoholic drink made from, the maguey cactus, like made from the same thing that like mezcal is made from, but it's not distilled. And so it's like beer or wine in terms of its kind of alcohol content. I think closer to wine than beer. And this would have been like the main alcoholic beverage available to people in that society, and its use was pretty strictly controlled. only people who either like had certain privileges or who were old and did not work were permitted to drink pulque, like other than on special occasions. So there were like festivals where people would drink pulque, but other than that, it was a privilege. And old people were permitted to drink pulque because since they didn't work, they weren't going to go out and drunkenly mess up the job they were supposed to be doing. But so we may have a similar situation, not necessarily in terms of the like centralized regulation of who can and can't have soma, but that maybe not everyone has access to it. And that has potential in a game, I feel, especially if we're going to say that soma really is a god, that when you drink soma the drink, you are communing with soma the god in some way. I mean, perhaps the reason that the soma deity doesn't have a stat block in this section is that he's not out there on the same planes as the other gods. He is, in fact, manifest on the prime material plane in the form of the drink, soma. And so this could even be your explanation for why you have, you know, potions of various kinds, right? You know, soma could just be, like the obvious example is something like in older D&D, the potion of heroism, which just kind of boosts you in several ways. Just kind of makes you a bigger, better version of yourself, which is kind of what I feel like is being described in these soma hymns, the idea of having like spiritual purification, or you could treat it as a cure-all. I don't know how much there is a discussion of its medicinal properties. It seems more preventative than curative, but it seems like a good fit for your kind of characteristic healing clerics, especially as you get into later editions of D&D, removing status effects, as they say, is one of the main things that clerics can do better than anyone else. If you've been cursed or poisoned or whatever, you know, you really want to get helped by a cleric. You know, whatever you've got, from mummy rot to lycanthropy, cleric, a sufficiently high-level cleric, may have some way to do it. And so that would make sense if soma connects the idea of bodily health with spiritual purity, which is also an idea that's very widespread in religions of all kinds. You know, look at physical spiritual practices from things like fasting or yoga or what have you, and the way that they are connected to the health of the soul. Not necessarily even saying like, oh, your soul is dirty and that's why you got sick, but if you do these physical things, then it would be good for your soul. So you can actually do that with the kind of healing cleric. It's interesting, isn't it, that the kind of stereotype of the cleric as Christian clergy sort of mean that relatively common ideas in the world of religion that actually fit the like play role of the cleric very seldom get applied to it because they don't come from the cultural context that the image of the cleric comes from. Imagine that I talked for a bit about the dissonance of clerics as, you know, healers and fighters. The attempt to sort of approach that in 5th edition by having, well, and going back to 3rd edition, and probably earlier, by having lots of very different specialized clerics, each of whom have particular abilities in particular domains, never really addresses the fact that nonetheless there is this core of healing and protective magic that all clerics really share, because that is fundamentally their role in the game part of the game. And if it wasn't always, it is now. So I feel like you can square that circle as a cleric whose thing is preparing soma. There might even just be certain orders of clerics that's all they do, right? Their healing is not that they go out in the world and cast cure wounds on people, but that they produce the soma, which helps keep people healthy and helps purify people's souls. But I can see why you might not want to have as a central part of your mythology a deity who encourages people. How intoxicating is soma? We don't know. You know, are they out there drinking Buckfast tonic wine, or are they out there drinking a nice cup of tea in terms of encouraging antisocial behavior? Who knows? But you could do either. You could have this ritual that ends with, you know, sharing a cup with the cleric, and that kind of gives you a mild little boost. Or you could have, you know, ecstatic worshippers getting all hopped up on the god's magical drink and charging out to do battle with whoever offers it. I do like it when there are drink sharing rituals and food sharing rituals in games, right? communal feasting and communal drinking, a very important part of many societies, and kind of something that doesn't come up a lot in games. All right, anyway, look, that's about all the time that we have for Soma. In our next episode, we're going to be taking a look at a couple of deities who, although they don't fall into this chapter's Vedic ambit, are nonetheless too cool to pass by without being included. I said deities, actually. Only one of them is really a deity. The other is a legendary figure. And we may wind up talking about some other things. I have some that are kind of on the cusp, whether I want to include them or not. But we'll see how it goes as we talk about Ganesh and Hanuman on the next episode of Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.